Turn Your Eyes Upon Jesus, which is the name of a song written by Helen Lemmel. She lived from 1863 to 1961. During her lifetime, and actually at a fairly young age, but as a young married woman, she became blind, and it wasn't long after that her husband left her. So this song has as its refrain, "Turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace." So she wrote that song, including the lyrics and the music, a little over 100 years ago. And she wrote it as a blind person and was able to see through the eyes of faith as she would direct her attention to the Lord. She wrote over 500 songs. And although she died impoverished, and that she seems to have been a very joyful believer, had quite a testimony, and was singing and writing songs, communicating truths that she was recognizing from the scripture. And this song is her most famous one, and it has a message that is pertinent all the way through the passage that we will consider. That's assuming that we get all the way through verse 25. We may end up cutting that a bit short. Let me remind you here of what we considered over the past couple of weeks. Jesus was, of course, crucified. And then in chapter 20, his resurrection is the setting behind all that takes place there. We had Mary Magdalene, accompanied by other women, that went to the tomb. They saw the stone was rolled away. And she immediately left, perhaps not even meeting the angels that the other women spoke with, as recorded in the synoptics. She went and told John and Peter. Well, then, as a result of her getting them to go, she accompanied them. They went in. Both of them seemed to have come to appreciate, we're told explicitly that John believed in the resurrection as a result of seeing the orderly appearance of the now empty tomb. Peter seems also to have believed. I won't go into the details on that. If you need to see how I reached that conclusion, you can listen to the message on the pertinent passage in chapter 20. But then, Mary remained behind. She was distraught. And finally, Jesus revealed himself to her. And when that was concluded, he told her to go and to tell his disciples that he, Jesus, had not yet gone to his Father and their Father, his God and their God. An indirect statement that the disciples were believers. But it's very interesting. Jesus commissioned her to report to the disciples. She did so. As a result, there are three attested appearances by Jesus. We are going to look at the third of those, which is chapter 21, verses 1 through 14. Now, this clearly is setting a flow here for the final section of the book, that in chapter 20 we have the first appearance to of 10 disciples, and then we have the second appearance in chapter 20 to 11 disciples. Now in chapter 21 we get the third appearance to his disciples after his resurrection, and that is to 7. But something that we called attention to last time is that Mary was commissioned to report to the disciples, and that led to there being 3 attested appearances. This corresponds to something that happens at the opening of the body of the book in chapter 1. John the Baptist was commissioned by the Father to testify of the coming Messiah, Jesus. He did so. And he directed his disciples to Jesus by saying in chapter 1, "Behold the Lamb of God." And that led to 3 testimonies by former disciples of John the Baptist that then started to follow Jesus. So we have a corresponding role between that of John the Baptist in chapter 1 and of Mary Magdalene in chapter 20. So here we are, we're looking at this passage, chapter 21, and something that is going to follow through all the way through this whole section is that everybody needs their eyes turned upon Jesus. So let's look at the miraculous catch preceded by a miserable catch. Now, I show you Tabgha, and I've been there. Tabgha is the name of an area. It was an abandoned town. So there isn't a town there anymore. There's a church and a few things around there. But Tabgha is a shortened form of Heptapegon, which is saying in Greek, 7 springs. As a result of water coming in the way that it does through those 7 springs, this area, we were told by our guide, is still an area that's good for fishing. So it's a logical place for the 7 disciples to be just offshore of trying to net fish. Good location for fish. And so we'll have more to say about this, but Tabgha is the likely location. There is not a direct identification by name in John 21, but this would be a very likely place, and seems to have documentation from fairly early after the New Testament was completed, that this is indeed the locale. Okay. Going into Capernaum, this is where Jesus made his headquarters for the early part of his ministry. And in Capernaum is a location, a building, that has been tentatively identified as Peter's house. We can't say absolutely that it was, but a lot of Christian markings within, a lot of lamps, which since churches tended to meet in the evenings, they would have needed lamps in order to be able to read. Lots of Christian insignias, all sorts of things like that. It would be a likely church or house church, which very possibly could have been Peter's house. But the disciples gathered together. Let's look at verses 1 and 2. We're told, "After these things, Jesus again manifested himself to his disciples by the Sea of Tiberias," that's another name for the Sea of Galilee, "and he manifested himself in this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, called Twin, Nathanael from Cana of Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of the disciples were together. So, presumably, they were together in Cana, where Peter and some of the other disciples in Capernaum, where Peter and some of the other disciples made their residence. This is a very good possibility as to where they were. So we have seven disciples that are gathered together. Now you might wonder, why is Thomas called Twin? Well, Thomas means twin, and the word twin, of course, means twin. Apparently, Thomas is not his real name, but it's a nickname. Just as Nathanael seems to be the real name for Bartholomew. Bartholomew means son of Tolmoy, and so other accounts, the synoptics, call him Bartholomew, but that's all indications within the text are that Nathanael is to be identified with them. So then we have James and John, the sons of Zebedee, and we have two unnamed disciples. Well, Peter said, I'm going fishing. But now we have a question here that arises. Why only seven? Wouldn't we expect that all 11 of the disciples would have been together? Well, I would suspect that they probably were all together. But this particular picture here is in Utah, and they have invasive fish that they're having to deal with, carp, and they harvest them in order to cut down the numbers. But if you look, this boat is sitting rather low in the water. If you have a commercial fisherman like Peter, would you want to have 11 guys in the boat and not be able to haul in any fish? I mean, the more people you have, the less fish you can haul. Peter wasn't expecting to get skunked that night, so it's very possible that all the disciples were together, but only seven went aboard. Can't say that for sure, but that's a reasonable possibility as to why seven went on the boat, but there may have been additional ones present. Not able to say. John doesn't go into detail on that. Now Peter says in verse 3, I am going fishing. They told him, we also are coming with you. They went and immediately boarded the boat, yet on that night they caught nothing. This is the so-called Jesus boat. During 1986, when the water was low in the Sea of Galilee, a couple of brothers who tended to go along the shoreline looking for artifacts ran into part of a boat. It suddenly was apparent, whereas normally it was covered by water. And so that has been preserved, and archaeologists have analyzed it, and it is on display. I have been here. I have seen it in person. On the lower right inset, you see what conceivably it would have looked like. This is the size that boats typically were. And it would have been able to handle the weight of 12 disciples plus Jesus when nobody's fishing, but same boats would be used for fishing as well, but then of course you would have a smaller crew. It seems the size crew that they would normally have would be about five. You need to have several men in order to be able to hoist a net on board if it's full of fish. But Jesus said, you don't have any fish, do you? Leading question, expecting no. And so here they are, and they got skunked that night. They aren't empty nesters, they're empty netters. And they had schools of fish around. That is pretty smart fish. This one here says from John chapter 13, apart from Jesus, y'all professional fishermen can do nothing. And they proved it. They didn't do anything that night. So Jesus said, you don't have any fish, do you? And then he told them, drop your nets on your starboard side. And I can imagine these professional fishermen, we have at least four of them that were professional fishermen, saying, who does that stranger on the beach think that he is telling us how to fish? We know how to fish. And it might have been even out of spite that they would throw their net out the starboard side just to prove that stranger on the beach wrong. Here's an illustration of casting a net, but and this one has floats. Here we have a couple of fellows somewhere in Asia that are casting a net. But when they did that, they were unable to haul it in. Now, so let's read verses 4 through 6. Now, as it was already becoming dawn, Jesus stood on the shore. The disciples, however, did not know it was Jesus. So Jesus said to them, little children, you don't have any fish, do you? The way this sentence is written, it expects a negative answer. They answered him, no. He told them, cast the net on the boat's starboard side, and you all will find some. So they cast and could no longer pull it in because of the multitude of fish. All those guys getting a hold of the net, it was too heavy. It was more fish than the net had ever held in it. They couldn't pull it up. So, John says he is the Lord. Look at verse 7. That disciple whom Jesus loved told Peter, he is the Lord. When Simon Peter heard he is the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped, and plunged into the sea. The question here is, what was it that told John that this is Jesus? Well, back in John chapter 15, I think I said 13 at an earlier point, I meant 15. In John 15, Jesus, in talking about the vine, made a statement that the disciples needed to abide in him. When you look at John 13 through 17, the initial audience of that entire section are the disciples. At this point, Judas is gone, so this was directed to the 11. And he says, apart from me, you can do nothing. They needed to abide in him. Now, the question here is, were they at this point abiding in Jesus? Well, it kind of sounds like they're on their own here. And it's been proposed that Peter was saying, you know, I'm going back to fishing. I'm forgetting about all this stuff. I don't think he was planning to forget all of it. No indications there. After all, they've had two prior appearances by Jesus that are recorded for us in John. But I think that Peter's saying, well, we got to kill some time. Might as well make some money. Might as well catch some fish. We'll have some fish to sell. The family business of the sons of Zebedee is probably still alive and well. Their father is probably still in the wholesale business. All of this is something that Well, they're not going to be conducting ministry, so might as well go fishing. But John may have remembered this statement. But then there's something else. There was that miraculous catch. All of a sudden, they have more fish than they know what to do with. And that's just like Jesus. Jesus provides in abundance when he fed the 5,000, and that everything has the earmarks. That stranger on the beach is Jesus. They get their eyes focused on him now. Everything changes. So, he is the Lord. Peter plunged into the sea. Probably wasn't wearing quite that much clothes, since seems like he took off his outer robe. But Peter's out in front of the boat. They're not very far offshore. Jesus is on shore, and we're told, but the other disciples came by boat, verse 8, dragging the net with fish. They couldn't pull it up into the boat, so they hold on, and some of the guys are rowing. Maybe that's useful now to have six guys. They were not far from land, but only about 100 yards. Mark something else. So, in verse 9, we're told, so when they went out onto land, they saw a charcoal fire, a small fish lying on it, and bread. Jesus told them, bring now some of the fish you caught. The fire that they saw, okay, Jesus made a fire, but there's fish on it. Where did he get his fish? Did he go fishing? John doesn't tell us. But Jesus could go fishing without even getting his feet wet. But Jesus told them, bring some of the fish you caught. By the way, the Greek, unlike English, all the indications are that fish is not a mass noun in Greek as it is in English. Almost every occasion in John's Gospel that you see words for fish, it's in the plural. What do I mean about a mass noun? If I were to say, I caught fish, you don't know if I caught one, two, three, 10. You don't know if I hit my limit or not. All it tells you is I got at least one. Because we don't have to say I caught fishes. When you have count nouns, you have a separate plural form. Now, the word fishes does exist, but in English, we will often use the singular and have it stand for the plural. It appears that Greek did not do this. If they meant plural fish, they used a plural form. Jesus had one fish on the fire. So that's why he told them to get more fish. Now, let me say that Jesus said, BYOF, bring your own fish. Now, in the Sea of Galilee, there are 26 varieties of fish, but there are 19 that are native. The others are ones that have been brought in from elsewhere. I've had one of these fish, by the way, when I was in Israel. But there are a couple of details that help us to narrow down what type of fish it is. It is a type of fish that can be netted. There are varieties that are in there that are basically minnow-sized, and they didn't net them, and that's a, and then you have some varieties that can get very large, but that they use hooks and they don't net them. So it has to be something that can be netted. It has to be kosher. They have catfish, but according to the rules of the Old Testament, since catfish don't have scales, they are not kosher. So they would be the bad fish, as recorded in the synoptics. And it has to be sufficiently heavy so that if you have seven men trying to pull in a net with 153 fish, that they were incapable of pulling it in. The size of the St. Peter's fish, tilapia zilli, of 3.5 pounds is fairly common. They can get up to 5 pounds. 153 times 3.5 pounds would be quite a bit of weight to try to pull in over the side of a boat into the hold. We're told that Peter got out and was dragging. This artist has pictured a couple of other disciples helping him. Conceivable. John may have focused upon Peter as the main one. Doesn't mean that he didn't have help. But anyway, we have the fish being dragged ashore. You might notice this artist has depicted a few rocks here and there, but mainly a sandy beach. Let's see, not the best order here, but why 153? You wouldn't believe how much has been written with people speculating on what 153 signifies. Reason for 153? That's how many they caught. It might have been the total capacity of that net. I mean, the amount of net that was in the water, there might not have been room for any more fish in it. That might be why it's 153. But it was a full net. Peter, we're told, counted the fish. That's how they knew there were 153. In part, that documents the size of the miracle that Jesus did, but Peter is a commercial fisherman. He's there adding up his checkbook. I mean, you know, what would you expect a commercial fisherman to do? He's obviously going to count his catch. But we're told that even though there were so many and that net weighed so much, they dragged it ashore and the net was not torn. Now look at the shoreline here. There's a problem that John hasn't mentioned. There not only was this was a heavy net, but it's going to drag across these rocks. Quite a miracle Jesus has done. The net has not torn. You wonder why in the Synoptic Gospels you see them mending their nets? Makes sense. I mean, the fact that they were netting only about 100 yards offshore, nowhere in the Sea of Galilee is it real deep. Seems to me that maximum depth is somewhere around 50 feet. Don't quote me, but you know, it's not a deep lake. And so if you're not far from shore, the water isn't all that deep, so it wouldn't be at all hard for your net to end up dragging. That's a real possibility. So, verse 11, Simon Peter went up and dragged the net ashore, full of large fish, 153. And although being so many, the net was not torn. In verse 12, Jesus told them, come and eat breakfast. But none of the disciples dared ask him, who are you? Because they knew he was the Lord. Thinking back to this picture, they saw him, and I suspect that they were saying, who does that stranger think he is telling us professional fishermen how to fish? question was, who is that guy? And the answer came when they had that net that was so full. So none of them dared ask. They knew the answer. They knew it was the Lord. I think John has put this in as a humorous touch. They now have their eyes fixed on him. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Earlier in this passage, they were kind of wandering in the dark. Nothing good came that night until they obeyed what Jesus had to say. Now in verse 13, so Jesus came, took bread, gave it to them, and likewise the fish. So they're able here soon after dawn to have breakfast with Jesus. I'm sure that Jesus was teaching them. We're not given details except that which is directly pertinent to this narrative. But now we're told this was now the third time Jesus was manifested to his disciples after being raised from among the dead ones. You might wonder, why do I translate it the dead ones? Well, it's plural in Greek. You know, it's kind of an interesting thing. Most people think, treat it as though passages were saying Jesus was raised from death. Now, that's true, and there's at least one passage that expresses it that way. But when you see the translation in the New Testament, various places that say that he was raised from the dead, when it's written that way, the word dead is plural. Unlike corpses that remain unresurrected, Jesus was resurrected out of the mass of humanity that at that point, all the rest of them were unresurrected. So he was raised from among the dead ones, the one and only to have that happen at that time. It's called the firstborn from the dead, and there's more than one significance of that, but one of the features is he was the first one to be resurrected, never to die again. But let's look at this where it's now the third time. Back now, it's not absolutely the third time he appeared. But it is the third time that John mentions. And the time to Mary Magdalene is not counted. She's not one of his disciples. But we have three times after she went and reported to the disciples that Jesus appeared to disciples. The first one, he appeared to 10. Second one, he appeared to 11. Thomas was present, and Thomas made his confession. The third time is now here in chapter 21. These three appearances after the testimony by Mary Magdalene correspond to John the Baptist testifying in John 1 that led to three testimonies by former disciples of John the Baptist, all of those appearing in John chapter 1. It's like a sandwich. John has tied the book together, the body of the book, which starts at 1:15 and concludes at 21:14 with a situation similar between what John the Baptist did and what resulted, and what Mary Magdalene did and what resulted. So that now leads us to Peter being reinstated. That's in verses 15 through 19. And once again, we are going to see an emphasis upon turn your eyes upon Jesus. See how this goes. Now, We have an important issue to discuss because many preachers have commented on this, and I think a lot of what has been said is beside the point, irrelevant, and ends up being a distraction from the passage as a whole. Many preachers wrongly make strong differentiations between two words for love that Greek uses, agapao and phileo. They note that when Jesus asked the question the first two times, he uses agapao. The third time, he used phileo. But Peter, in all three of his answers, uses phileo. And so I'm going to talk about the usage of those words, and I'm going to argue that they are probably very, very similar in meaning here. I don't think that a strong differentiation is intended. And if there's any differentiation at all, it's not to say that Peter had a substandard kind of love. That's not the point under any case. So we're going to delve into an analysis of these two words. I'm not going to go through the 142 times that agapao is used in the New Testament and the 116 times that agape is used in the New Testament, but many people see it as though the Great Wall of China is dividing between the two uses, and that agapao means one thing, and it is not at all equivalent to phileo. Never the twain shall meet. They're across opposite sides of the wall, and they have very different meanings. I don't agree with that at all. I don't think that the evidence points in that direction. But it is such a common thing that people say about this passage that it deserves an extended comment. Now, here we have two words that have very different meanings. A man is not a woman, and a woman is not a man. There are some people that haven't figured that out recently, but these are quite distinct terms. And you might think, well, you know, people say, well, phileo and agapao are quite distinct. They would see it like this, two distinct entities that have no crossover whatsoever. Under this definition for men, there is no crossover. But if I say man is mortal, well, that's using man to stand for humanity, and it will include both men and women. Men are mortal. Women are mortal. In this sentence, man equals humanity, which includes men and women. So, when you look at the term man, in some of its uses, man has no overlap with the word woman, and sometimes it can be used in a way that women will be included under the definition. So, when we have words that sometimes overlap and sometimes don't, we would do a Venn diagram like this that would say that these are, that the meaning can be distinct or the meaning can overlap. So, now the question becomes, when we're looking at agapao and phileo, is there no overlap between them? Is there a little overlap? Is there much overlap? Or are they absolute synonyms, total overlap, where there's no difference of meaning whatsoever between one or the other? So words can have different amounts of overlap between none, to little, to much, to total. Which model describes agapao versus phileo. Well, we're going to bust some myths about agapao. Myth number one regarding agapao. This myth is stated, agape love is the highest form of love, a divinely enabled love. When people say that, they say, well, the word agape or agapao were not very common at all in secular Greek before the time of the New Testament, so therefore the New Testament decided to use that term and to freight it with a very distinct meaning, and it always refers to a kind of love that's supernatural, that requires God. An unbeliever is incapable of executing this term. I mean, you know, this term is absolutely a term that only applies to believers. Well, how does that explain John chapter 3, verse 19? Men loved, and the term there is agapao, men loved darkness rather than light. Doesn't seem like a text that is narrowly focused on Christians. Looks like it talks about unbelievers as well. Let's look at some other passages. Matthew chapter 5, verse 46. If you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? Doing the same means tax collectors love those who love them. Agapao. Are we going to say every tax collector was a believer? Are we going to say agapao love is divinely enabled? I don't think that works there. Does that meaning stand up in Luke 6:32, which is parallel to the Matthew passage? But if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. Or then in Luke 7:5, have people that are praising a centurion and saying, Jesus, go and heal his servant because, yeah, he's a Gentile, but he loves Israel, and he's even built us a synagogue. I mean, with his own money, he spent it, and you know, he's a very worthy person. Go heal him. Well, this is another good fairy tale, a good tooth fairy tale, that when people say that it has to be a God-enabled Christian type of love that unbelievers can't exercise. No evidence that this centurion at this point is a believer, but we have Jewish people that are reporting. They have no idea that there's a special vocabulary or anything like that. I say it loves our nation. Not talking about a divinely enabled love. Jesus told a story in Luke 7:42. There are two debtors, one that owed a big debt and one that owed a small debt, and they couldn't repay it, and so the man to whom they owed the money forgave the debt of both of them. Tell me, therefore, which of them will love him more? Now, Jesus is addressing this to a rather raunchy Pharisee who invited Jesus for a meal, but then proceeded to have derogatory thoughts and some derogatory words directed towards Jesus. And so Jesus told that story to illustrate that man. Therefore I say to you, her, that is the woman that this man has identified as a sinner, says, Jesus, said to himself, Jesus, if he knew what kind of woman she is, if he were a prophet, he wouldn't allow her to touch him. And Jesus said, well, you know, she welcomed me. She did all sorts of things. You didn't. Her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loves little. He's saying, how much have I forgiven of you? Little. Actually, none. And Jesus is saying, well, it's quite evident. You're kind of a raunchy guy. Each of these three uses is agapao. And when he's talking about the Pharisee, is he talking about divinely enabled love? I think not. Then in Luke 11:43, woe to you Pharisees, for you love the best seats, agapao, in the synagogues and the greetings in the marketplaces. 2 Timothy 4:10, for Demas, a believer, has forsaken me, having loved this present world and has departed for Thessalonica. Is Paul saying God enabled this believer to forsake me? God wanted him to. God wanted him to agapao the present world instead of having his eyes focused on the Lord and his word. I don't think that's talking about divine enablement. And in 1 John 2:15, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, love of the Father's love is not in him. Again, that's not divinely enabled love. Okay, so the first myth, that it only refers to divinely enabled love, is not correct. People also say, well, agape or agapao love is never conditional. It's not based on what you can do for me, and so on and so forth. But that doesn't explain John 3:19. Men love darkness rather than the light. They loved it because it didn't expose their sin. That's love because, that's not love in spite. Matthew 5:46. Loving those who love you, that's conditional love. Centurion loves Israel, probably because he saw that it was superior to whatever his religious background was as a loyal Roman. Is that unconditioned? No, that's conditional. He sees a benefit. The two debtors. The love is in response to having been forgiven a debt, or not loving because of not having been forgiven a debt. Clearly, that's talking about conditional love. Loving the best seats, well, that's getting praise, getting benefit. That's clearly conditional. Demas said, I'm out of here because it's too much pressure. He wanted to escape pressure. That's conditional love. Loving the world or the things in it, that's conditional love. Agapao can be used for conditional love. Then people say, well, unbelievers can't have agape love. Well, men love darkness rather than light? Doesn't seem like that's exclusively believers. Tax collectors and sinners loving those who love them? Not describing believers. What about the centurion? Anyone want to say he was a believer already before he knew about Jesus? What about the Pharisee? And then woe to you Pharisees. Myth number four. They say these terms are not synonymous, but that doesn't explain these passages, John 3:35, 5:20, 10:17, and 15:9, which speak of the Father loving the Son. Three of those, the three in red, 3:35, 10:17, and 15:9, all use agapao, but 5:20 uses phileo. The Father loves the Son, Jesus Christ, and John was quite willing to use both terms. Doesn't seem like he's sharply differentiating these terms. Then another evidence against people saying that these aren't synonymous, that we have five passages that speak of John, the disciple whom Jesus loved. Four of those are uses of agapao. John 13:23, 19:26, 21:7, and 21:20. But chapter 20, verse 2, is phileo. And then myth number 5 is that it's less significant to be a friend or friendship type of love, which philos has that range of meaning, is less important, less valuable than being someone who is beloved, agapetos. However, becoming a friend of Jesus is a privilege extended only to the closest connection with him that a believer can have. When Jesus talks about friends, his friends, that is the pinnacle of close relationship with Jesus. Here's an interesting thing. When we believe in Jesus, we cease to be God's enemy. But that does not equate to we immediately become Jesus' friend. There's a quantitative and qualitative difference between not being his enemy and becoming his friend. Think about after World War II. Immediately, hostilities against the Axis nations ended. But that did that mean that all the GIs were saying, wow, that fellow over there that I'm arresting and making sure that he has surrendered his weapons and can go to be interrogated and perhaps to be imprisoned and so forth, is he now my best friend? Well, he might not be my enemy, but that doesn't make him immediately my friend. So, let's look at this. Agapao does not, the fact that there are uses that clearly are not divinely enabled love means that when people say that's what it means, the term demands a divinely enabled love. No, it doesn't. People also say, well, it's never conditional. Well, here are examples where it is. Then they say, only believers can have it. Well, here are cases where unbelievers have it. And then we have agapao and phileo being synonymous. And then we have that philos, which is the noun form, the equivalent to agape. Phileo is a verb, agapao is a verb, philos is the noun, and phileo is the verb. Philos translates as love, but if it's talking about someone who is loved that way, the term that we have as it's translated is friend, but it actually literally means a beloved one. So, a loved one. Therefore, I am not going to say that the argument of this passage demands that we say agapao is superior to phileo. That is an overreading, and you'll notice that we did have passages in John's writings that illustrate that these terms are not differentiated the way that people often portray them. So, many strong strongly differentiate between agapao and phileo in this passage. And I would say that is incorrect. That is not justified by the passage. Now, we have an interesting phrase that shows up in verse 15. It says, Simon, do you love me more than these? In your handout said, as my old translation has read it, these things, but I think it's these people. If Jesus were wanting to make the point, do you love me more than you love this, he would have used a singular form of, and it would have been neuter form. And that would have referred to fishing. Doesn't sound likely. It's weird wording if he were saying, do you love me more than you love these fish? It would be fishing, not these fish, that would be the object of Peter's love for the comparison. So now the question becomes, if fisherman is what is meant, and the form will allow whether it be fish or fisherman, but I would strongly suggest that fisherman is the idea, but the question becomes, what part would fisherman play within the sentence? Number three would be, do you love me more than you love these fishermen? Or do you love me more than these fishermen love me? For a long time, I was opposed to view number four because I thought that it required Peter to be introspective and would say, Peter, I want you to figure out whether you love me more than others love me. And that, under normal circumstances, would not seem like an advisable thing to urge someone to consider. But there's something in the background in the book of John that makes it so that option four is best. Now, as I note, grammar will not allow option one. Option two likely has the same meaning as option one, but it would be weird wording to say, do you love these fish, these 153 dead fish more than you love me? That doesn't make sense. It would be worded differently if Jesus were saying, do you love this, that is fishing, more. It would be different wording, it would be a different form. Option three is possible, but John 13:37 pushes us to the fourth one. That is, do you love me more than the rest of these fishermen love me? Why? Peter evidenced a superiority complex back in John 13:37, where he said, Lord, why cannot I follow you now? I will lay down my mortal life for you. I'm willing to die for you. That's why he was willing to pull out that sword and chop off the ear of the high priest servant. He didn't have very good aim. He was aiming at killing that guy. But he was trying to lay down his life. He was trying to protect Jesus at the expense of his life. The parallel in Mark 14:29 here to 13:37, Peter said to him, even if all the others are made to stumble, yet I will not be made to stumble. I am more loyal than the other disciples. He has a superiority complex. It is in light of that that Jesus asked the question, okay, Peter, you told me the night before I was crucified that everybody else might desert me, but you wouldn't. Are you still standing on that? Are you still maintaining? I have a superior love. It's beyond that of the other disciples. Now, if Peter is wanting to make a differentiation between agapao and phileo. And I said, it shouldn't be a strong differentiation, and it wouldn't mean that Peter's saying, well, I'm not willing to have the kind of love you want me to have. If he is using it here with the idea of a difference, on the left he had a big head, and now he's saying, I love you, but I'm not certain how strong I am. So if he is making a differentiation, it's because he has been brought to his knees. Jesus is going to seek to get Peter stabilized. And he's going to do that by turning Peter's eyes to himself. It's going to be a really fascinating thing that happens in this passage. Peter used to have a really high opinion of himself. Now I think he's been crushed. Even the first time Jesus asks it, he really is crushed by the third time Jesus asks it, as we are all aware. Peter's fear goes back to Jesus describing the hireling that is entrusted to watch over sheep, but when he sees a wolf coming, he runs away. What is the nature of his fear? He's saying, I may be disapproved for ministry and disapproved for rewardability. I may have just absolutely blown it. And right now I'm wondering if I'm going to hear Jesus say, Peter, remember I predicted you were going to deny me. Peter, I'm going to have to remove you from the roster. Peter is quaking in his boots right now. And he definitely is not wanting to communicate to Jesus, hey, I've got a big head, and that, because he knows that he can't necessarily deliver on all that he thought he could deliver on. And he's worried about what's going to happen next. Is the other shoe going to drop? But there's something that Peter missed in this passage. Jesus said, feed my lambs. Notice the cross-out symbol in the word disapproved. Jesus is not hinting that Peter has been disapproved for ministry. Peter isn't going to pick that up. He isn't even going to pick it up by the third time. Let's go through this. So Jesus asked that first time, Peter, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these love me? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus told him, feed my lambs. Jesus isn't saying, scram, get out of here. He's saying, I have some ministry for you to do. Feed my lambs. Jesus doesn't seem to be saying, oh, you have an inferior kind of love. You just use phileo. Nothing like that is going on here. So a second time, He again said to him, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? He told him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He told him, shepherd my sheep. Once again, it doesn't sound like disqualification, doesn't sound like disapproval, doesn't sound like you're a hireling, get out of here. He asked him a third time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? Now I want you to notice something. In verse 16, it said a second time he asked him. A second time he again said to him. And now in verse 17, he said to him the third time. Okay, the first time he used agapao. Second time he used agapao. Third time he used phileo. But John is telling us these are three questions that mean the same thing. This is further evidence. There is not a differentiation being made by the apostle as he's writing that, oh, Jesus is accommodating him and he goes down to a lower term. It's a third asking of the same question with the same meaning, despite the use of a different verb. John is famous for his use of synonyms. But notice, Peter was grieved. Why was he grieved? Because he said to them, third time, do you love me? That's reinforcing. Jesus asked three times a question with the same meaning, despite the fact that Jesus used a different verb for love. And he said to him, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus told him, feed my sheep. Okay, Peter was distraught. Peter's not picking up on the clues. Jesus has told him, feed my lambs, shepherd my sheep. And then after Peter's answer on the third one, Jesus says, feed my sheep. Jesus isn't pointing to disapproval. He's not saying you're a hireling. He's not saying, Peter, I know you're a believer, but you have no role on the team. You've blown it. Peter is clearly being reminded that he has denied Jesus three times. But Jesus says, feed my sheep. Now, Jesus has given little clues that should be helping Peter out. But Peter is grieved. Peter is expecting the axe to fall. He is expecting to be cut from the team. He's grieved. Jesus has three times told him, I want you to minister. I'm not cutting you from the team. And now Jesus is going to do something that until my son George came up to me many years ago, somewhere around 2012 or 2013, so a long time ago, I said, Dad, but working through your messages on John, he was working for us and was doing some work on some passages that I had assigned for him to deal with. He came up to me one day and he said, Dad, in going through that, I have figured out why Jesus told Peter how he was going to die. And I was all ears because up until that point, I hadn't figured it out. It was always a bit of a puzzlement why that was here. But Jesus is going to reinforce the positive message that he's been giving. Peter has just been hearing negative. I'm going to be cut from the team. I'm a hireling. I blew it. And it's over and it's done with. I'm going to be fired. Jesus says, "Amen, amen, I tell you, when you were younger, you girded yourself and walked where you wished. But when you grow old, you will extend your hands and another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish to go." Now he said this, signifying by what kind of death he will glorify God. After saying this, he told him, "Follow me." The description here is that Peter is going to die on a cross. He's going to go where he does not want to go because someone's going to take him and they're going to stretch his arms out. He's going to be hung on a cross. Now, for most of us, that would be a real downer to be told, this is how you're going to die. You're going to die an excruciating death. But as my son George pointed out to me, this, in a very interesting turn of events, was a great encouragement to Peter. How so? Peter knows that he's not going to chicken out when it counts. You know, Peter was so confident that he said in Mark, "Even if all the rest of them abandon you, I will not. I will die for you." And lo and behold, Peter denied Jesus three times. Luke's account tells us that as the cock crowed, Peter's eyes and Jesus' eyes met. Peter went out weeping bitterly. It was just all that he could handle, that what Jesus had said was, "You're going to do it. You're going to deny me three times tonight." Peter had said, "Even if everybody else is made to stumble, not me. Not me, Lord." Jesus is telling him, when it counts, you are not going to chicken out. Can you imagine how that would have hung over Peter's head the rest of his life? Am I going to repeat history? Am I going to deny Jesus? Am I going to chicken out when the going gets rough? And what he's being told is, "You told me that you would give up your mortal life for me. You meant that. And it's going to happen." For most people, that would be an absolute downer. But for Peter, he's being told, "You don't have to worry. You're not going to chicken out." John tells us that Jesus has told him how his death would glorify God. Verse 19, "I said this, signifying by what kind of death he will glorify God." But Jesus says, "You need to follow me. You need to turn your eyes upon Jesus." This passage, Peter's all distracted at the beginning because of his failure. He's expecting to be cut from the team. Jesus is saying, "What you need in order for you to do what you are going to need to do, you've got to follow me. You've got to turn your eyes upon Jesus." But Peter is one who easily gets distracted. I've managed to get, I don't know why I put how Peter will glorify the Lord. It's rather the rumor about John not dying. I managed to get it into notes and up to here as well. Oh well. In verse 20, but turning, Peter saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following, who had reclined near his chest at the dinner, and said, Lord, who is the one betraying you? Upon seeing John, Peter said to Jesus, Lord, and what will he do? There was quite a bit of rivalry between Peter, James, and John. We see this at various points. Peter says, okay, I know basically what I'm going to do. What's John going to do? Jesus said, if I want him to abide until I come, what is that to you? Follow me. Peter's out snooping over the fence, trying to figure out someone else's business, and he needs to turn his eyes back upon Jesus. And so what Jesus is saying is, that's not pertinent to you, just like he had told his mother. Ma'am, what is that to me and to you? My hour has not yet come. Peter's getting focused on other people's things. Peter needs to get his eyes back on the Lord. But the word got out and people misunderstood. But notice, Jesus again directs Peter, follow me. That's what you need to do. You need to have your eyes fixed on me. Norman Rockwell did this painting called The Gossips. And it's of the telephone game that one person says to the next person, and when the message gets transmitted to the next, it changes a little bit, and it changes a little more, and by the time it reaches the end, it has a totally different meaning than it had when it started. Lo and behold, that's exactly what happened here in verse 23. So this word went out to the brethren that this disciple would not die. Yet Jesus had not told him that he would not die, but if I want him to abide until I come, what is that to you? The people that were spreading that message needed to get their eyes on Jesus, just like Peter did. So, Peter's not the only one that's susceptible to getting their eyes off Jesus. Then we have the epilogue, and this is where the ten testify that John's testimony is true. What we have here is eyewitness testimony. This is the disciple who testifies about these things and wrote them. Verse 24a is John saying, this is my eyewitness testimony. When he's talking about testimony, it's not like when someone says, oh, here's my personal testimony. I used to be a raunchy rat, and then I believed in Jesus, and everything changed. John's testimony is the Gospel of John, and it's not focused on John. He doesn't even name himself in the book. It is focused on Jesus. And everything is designed to direct people to looking at Jesus, his signs, his words, and concluding, Jesus is the life-giving Messiah. So they would, by believing, have life in his name. The second part of the verse, indeed we, which is the other disciples, know that his testimony is true. How is it that they know it's true? They were there. We're told in the purpose statement of John 20, 30, and 31, many other signs Jesus did in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in his book. But these, which were done in the presence of his disciples, are written in this book. Those disciples were there. They saw, they heard, they know. And back in chapter 1, verse 14, and the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us, the disciples, and we beheld his glory. His glory was revealed every sign that Jesus did. The other disciples are able to say, yes, this is true testimony from John. We were there. We affirm it. This book is true. Verse 25. And there are many other things that Jesus did, which if they were written one by one, I suppose that not even the world itself could hold the books that would be written. Amen. John is telling us that he is selective. He has made a sufficient case that those who believe in Jesus Christ for everlasting life have everlasting life, because Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, as proven by his signs that no one else could do. In tying this book together, every one of these, this chapter together, every one of these sections is talking about the need to fix our eyes upon Jesus. Miraculous catch when they were distracted and not operating in and under his command, Jesus let them see that indeed what he had said earlier, apart from him they could do nothing. But then they figured out that man on the beach is Jesus, because he told us to throw the net to the right side, and we got a catch that we've never had a catch like this before. They've received direct evidence. This is Jesus. They had breakfast with him. After breakfast, Peter is reinstated. But he's reminded he needs to have his eyes fixed on Jesus. He was distracted first by his failures, by having denied Jesus three times. They thought, Jesus can't use me. But Jesus was telling him, feed my lambs, tend my sheep, feed my sheep. Jesus wasn't disqualifying him. Jesus was planning to give ministry to him. Jesus then told him how he was going to die, so that Peter would know, I'm not going to deny him three times again. I'm going to hang tough and I'm going to fight the fight. Jesus was seeking to make it so that he would be strong in ministry, not doubting himself, not wondering, am I going to wander away from the Lord because of fear? But Peter had to have his eyes fixed on Jesus, not to look at what's John going to do. And others needed to know, they needed to hear what Jesus really said and not pass out rumors of what he didn't mean. But this is a book that is faithful to the truth, because not only was John a witness, but the other disciples testify that what he says is true. Okay, questions?